into the cell block and huddled with their clients with a row of bars between them, and with every other prisoner straining to eavesdrop. Occasionally, a lawyer would catch his client outside in the rec yard and give advice through chain link. Most often, though, the lawyers did not bother to visit their clients at the jail. They waited until they were hauled into court and chatted with them there. But John Wilbanks considered himself to be superior to every other lawyer in Ford County, if not the entire state, and his new criminal client was certainly a cut above the rest of Gridley's prisoners. Their status warranted a proper place to meet, and the sheriff's office would work just fine. Gridley finally acquiesced. Few people won arguments with John Wilbanks, who, by the way, had always supported the sheriff at election time, and after some mumbling and cussing and a few benign rules, left to fetch Pete. He brought him in with no handcuffs and said they could chat for half an hour. When they were alone, Wilbanks began with, "Okay, Pete, let's talk about the crime. If you did it, tell me you did it. If you didn't do it, then tell me who did." "I have nothing to say," Pete said and lit a cigarette. "That's not good enough. I have nothing to say." "Interesting. Do you plan to cooperate with your defense lawyer?" A shrug, a puff, nothing more. Wilbanks offered a professional smile and said, "Okay. Here's the scenario. In a day or two, they'll take you over to the courtroom for an initial appearance before Judge Oswald. I assume you'll plead not guilty. Then they'll bring you back here. In a month or so, the grand jury will meet and indict you for murder, first degree. I would guess that by February or March, Oswald will be ready for a trial, which I'm ready to handle, if that's what you want."
"John, you've always been my lawyer."
"Good. Then you have to cooperate."
"Cooperate?"
"Yes, Pete, cooperate. On the surface, this appears to be cold-blooded murder. Give me something to work with, Pete. Surely you had a motive."
"It's between me and Dexter Bell."
"No, it's now between you and the state of Mississippi, which, like all states, takes a dim view of cold-blooded murder."
"I have nothing to say."
"That's not a defense, Pete."
"Maybe I don't have a defense. Not one that folks would understand."
"Well, the folks on the jury need to understand something. My first thought, indeed my only one at this moment, is a plea of insanity."
Pete shook his head and said, "Hell no. I'm as sane as you are.
But I'm not facing the electric chair, Pete."
Pete blew a cloud of smoke and said, "I'm not doing that."
"Great. Then give me a motive, a reason. Give me something, Pete."
"I have nothing to say."
Joel Banning was walking down the steps outside Benson Hall when someone called his name. Another student, a freshman he knew of but had not met, handed him an envelope and said, "Dean Mulrooney needs to see you at once in his office. It's urgent."
"Thanks," Joel said, taking the envelope and watching the freshman walk away.
Inside, a handwritten note on official Vanderbilt stationery instructed Joel to please come without delay to the dean's office in Kirkland Hall, the administration building. Joel had a literature class in 15 minutes, and the professor frowned on absences. If he sprinted, he could run by the dean's office, tend to whatever matter was at hand, then arrive late for class and hope the professor was in a good mood. He hustled across the quad to Kirkland Hall and bounded up the stairs to the third floor, where the dean's secretary explained that he was to wait until precisely 11 a.m. when his Aunt Florrie would call from home. The secretary claimed to know nothing. She had spoken to Florrie Banning, who was calling on her rural party line and thus without privacy. Florrie planned to drive into Clanton and use the private line at a friend's home. As he waited, he assumed someone had died, and he could not help but think of those relatives and friends he preferred to lose before the others. The Banning family was small, just his parents, Pete and Liza, his sister Stella, and his Aunt Florrie. The grandparents were dead. Florrie had no children, thus he and Stella had no first cousins on the Banning side. His mother's people were from Memphis, but had scattered after the war. He paced around the office, ignoring the looks from the secretary, and decided it was probably his mother. She had been sent away months earlier, and the family was reeling. He and Stella had not seen her, and their letters went unanswered. Their father refused to discuss his wife's treatment, and, well, there were a lot of unknowns. Would her condition improve? Would she come home? Would the family ever be a real family again? Joel and Stella had questions, but their father preferred to talk about other matters when he chose to talk at all. Likewise, Aunt Florrie was of little help. She called at 11 a.m. on the dot. The secretary handed Joel the phone and stepped around a corner, though probably within earshot, he figured. Joel said hello, then listened for what seemed an eternity. Florrie began by explaining that she was in town at the home of Miss Mildred Highlander, a woman Joel had known his entire life, and she, Florrie, was there because the call needed to be private, and there was no privacy on their rural party line, as he well knew. And really, nothing was private in town right now, because his father had driven to the Methodist Church just hours earlier and shot and killed the Reverend Dexter Bell, and was now in jail. And well, as anyone could understand, the entire town was buzzing and everything had come to a complete stop. Don't ask why, and don't say anything that might get overheard, wherever you are, Joel. But it's just awful, and God help us. Joel leaned on the secretary's desk for support as he felt faint. He closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and listened. Florrie said she had just talked to Stella at Holland's, and she did not take it well. They had her in the president's office with a nurse. She explained that Pete had given her specific instructions, in writing no less, that they, Joel and Stella, were to stay at school and away from home and Clanton until further notice. They should make plans to spend Thanksgiving holidays with friends as far away from Ford County as possible. And if they were contacted by reporters, investigators, police, or anybody else, they were to say absolutely nothing. Not a word to anyone about their father or the family. Not a word, period. She wrapped things up by saying that she loved him dearly, would write a long letter immediately, and that she wished she could be there with him at this horrible moment. Joel put the phone down without a word and left the building. He drifted across the campus until he saw an empty bench, partially hidden by shrubbery. He sat there and fought back tears, determined to find the stoicism taught by his father. Poor Stella, he thought. She was as fiery and emotional as their mother, and he knew she was a mess at the moment. Frightened, bewildered, and confused, Joel watched the leaves fall and scatter in the breeze. He felt the urge to go home immediately, to catch a train and be in Clanton before dark, and once there, he would get to the bottom of things. The thought passed, though, and he wondered if he would ever go back. Reverend Bell was a gifted and popular minister, and at the moment there was probably great hostility toward the Bannings. Besides, his father had given him and Stella strict instructions to stay away. Joel, at the age of 20, could not remember a single instance when he had disobeyed his father. With age, he had learned to respectfully disagree with him, but he would never disobey him. His father was a proud soldier, a strict disciplinarian who said little and valued authority. There was simply no way his father could commit murder. Chapter 4. The courthouse and the shops and offices lining the neat square around it closed at 5 each weekday. Usually by that time, all doors were locked, all lights were off, the sidewalks were empty, and everyone was gone. However, on this day, the townsfolk lingered a bit later in case more facts and/or gossip emerged about the killing. They had talked of nothing else since 9 that morning. They had shocked each other with the first reports, then spread along later developments. They had stood in solemn respect as Old Man McGargle paraded his hearse around the square to provide a glimpse of the corpse outlined under a black cape. Some had ventured to the Methodist Church and held vigil while offering prayers, then returned to their places around the square with near breathless descriptions of what was happening on the front line. Baptists, Presbyterians, and Pentecostals were at a disadvantage since they could claim no real connection to either the victim or his killer. The Methodists, though, were in the spotlight, with each one eager to describe relationships that seemed to grow stronger as the day progressed. On this unforgettable day, the Clanton Methodist Church had never known so many congregants. For most people in Clanton, among the white folks anyway, there was a sense of betrayal. Dexter Bell was popular and highly regarded. Pete Banning was a near mythical figure. To have one kill the other was such a senseless loss, it touched almost everyone. Motive was so incomprehensible that no solid rumor emerged to address it. Not that there was a shortage of rumors. There certainly was not. Banning would be in court tomorrow. He was refusing to say anything. He would plead insanity. John Wilbanks had never lost a trial and was not about to lose this one. Judge Oswalt was a close friend of the Bannings, or maybe he was a close friend of Dexter Bell's. The trial would be moved to Tupelo. He had not been right since the war. Jackie Bell was heavily sedated. Her kids were a mess. Pete would put up his land as security for bail and go home tomorrow. To avoid seeing anyone, Flory parked on a side street and hurried to the law office. John Wilbanks was working late and waiting for her in the reception room on the first floor. In 1946, there were a dozen lawyers in Ford County, and half of them worked for the firm of Wilbanks and Wilbanks. All six were related. For over 100 years, the Wilbanks family had been prominent in law, politics, banking, real estate, and farming. John and his brother Russell studied law up north and ran the firm, which seemed to run most other commercial matters in the county. Another brother was the chairman of the largest bank in the county, along with owning several businesses. A cousin farmed 2,000 acres. Another cousin handled real estate and was also a state representative with ambitions. It was rumored that the family met in secret the first week of January of each year to tally up the various profits and divide the money. There seemed to be plenty to go around. Flory had known John Wilbanks since high school, though she was 3 years older. His firm had always taken care of the Bannings' legal matters, none of which had ever seemed that complicated until now. There had been the sticky problem of shipping Liza off to the asylum, But John had discreetly pulled the right strings, and away she went. Florrie's ancient divorce had likewise been swept under the rug by John and his brother, with hardly a record of it in the county books. He greeted her with a solemn hug, and she followed him upstairs to his large office, the finest in town, with a terrace that overlooked the courthouse square. The walls were covered with grim portraits of his dead ancestors. Death was everywhere. He waved at a rich leather sofa, and she took a seat. "I met with him," John began as he struck a match and lit a short black cigar. "He didn't say much. In fact, he's refusing to say anything."
"What in God's name, John?"
she asked as her eyes watered.
"Hell if I know. You didn't see it coming?"
"Of course not. You know Pete, he doesn't talk, especially about private matters. He'll chat a bit about his kids, go on like all farmers about the weather and the price of seed and all that drivel. But you get nothing personal. And something as awful as this, well, no. He would never say a word."
John sucked on his cigar and blasted a cloud of blue smoke at the ceiling.
"So you have no idea what's behind this?"
She dabbed her cheeks with a handkerchief and said,
"I'm too overwhelmed to make any sense of it, John. I'm having trouble breathing right now. Forget thinking clearly. Maybe tomorrow. Maybe the next day, but not now. Everything is a blur."
"And Joel and Stella?"
"I've spoken with both of them. Poor children. Away at school, enjoying the college life. Nothing really to worry about. And they get the news that their father has just murdered their minister, a man they admired. And they can't come home because Pete gave strict instructions, in writing no less, that they stay away until he changes his mind."
She sobbed for a minute as John worked his cigar. Then she clenched her jaws, dabbed some more, and said,
"I'm sorry."
"Oh, go ahead, Florrie. Cry all you want. I wish I could. Get it out of your system, because it's only natural. This is no time to be brave. Emotion is welcome here. This is a perfectly awful day that will haunt us for years to come."
"What is coming, John?"
"Well, nothing good. I can promise you that. I spoke with Judge Oswald this afternoon, and he will not even consider the notion of bail. Out of the question, which I completely understand. It is murder, after all. I met with Pete this afternoon, but he's not cooperative. So on the one hand, he will not plead guilty, and on the other, he won't provide any cooperation for a defense. This could change, of course, but you and I both know him, and he doesn't change his mind once it's made up."
"What kind of defense?"
"Our options appear to be rather limited. Self-defense, irresistible impulse, an alibi, perhaps. Nothing fits here, Florrie."
He pulled again on the cigar and exhaled another cloud.
"And there's more. I received a tip this afternoon and walked over to the land records office. 3 weeks ago, Pete signed a deed transferring ownership of his land to Joel and Stella. There was no good reason for doing this, and he certainly didn't want me to know about it. He used a lawyer from Tupelo, one with few contacts in Clanton."
"And the point is, I'm sorry, John, help me here."
"The point is, Pete was planning this for some time, and to protect his land from possible claims to be made by the family of Dexter Bell, he gave it to his children, took his name off the title."
"Will that work?"
"I doubt it. But that's another issue for another day. Your land is, of course, in your name and will not be affected by any of this."
"Thanks, John, but I haven't even thought about that."
"Assuming he goes to trial, and I can't imagine why he will not, the land transaction will be entered into evidence against him to prove premeditation. It was all carefully planned, Florrie.
Pete had been thinking about this for a long time. Flory held the handkerchief to her mouth and stared at the floor as minutes passed. The office was perfectly still and quiet. All sounds from the street below were gone. John stood and stubbed his cigar into a heavy crystal ashtray, then walked to his desk and lit another one. He went to the windows of a French door and gazed at the courthouse across the street. It was almost dusk, and the shadows were falling on the lawn. Without turning around, he asked, "How long was Pete in the hospital after he escaped?"
"Months and months. I don't know, maybe a year. He had extensive wounds and weighed 130 pounds. It took time."
"How about mentally? Were there problems?"
"Well, typically he's never talked about them if they in fact existed. But how can you not be a bit off in the head after going through what he endured?"
"Was he diagnosed?"
"I have no idea. He is not the same person after the war. But how could he be? I'm sure a lot of those boys are scarred."
"How is he different?"
She stuck her handkerchief in her purse, as if to say the tears were over for now.
"Liza said there were nightmares at first. A lot of sleepless nights. He's moodier now, prone to long stretches of silence, which he seems to enjoy. But then, you're talking about a man who's never said a lot. I do remember thinking that he was quite happy and relaxed when he got home. He was still convalescing and gaining weight, and he smiled a lot, just happy to be alive and happy the war was over. That didn't last, though. I could tell things were tense between him and Liza. Nineveh said they were not getting along. It was really strange because it seemed as though the stronger he got, the more he got himself together, the quicker she unraveled."
"What were they fighting about?"
"I don't know. Nineveh sees and hears everything, so they were careful. She told Marietta that they often sent her out of the house so they could discuss things. Liza was spiraling. I remember seeing her once not long before she went away, and she looked thin, frail, and sort of beleaguered. It's no secret that she and I have never been close, so she never confided in me. I guess he didn't either."
John puffed his cigar and returned to his seat near Flory. He stared at her with a pleasant smile, one old friend to another, and said, "The only possible connection between Reverend Bell, your brother, and a senseless murder is Liza Banning. Do you agree?"
"I'm in no position to agree to anything."
"Come on, Flory. Help me out here. I'm the only person who might be able to save Pete's life, and that looks pretty doubtful right now. How much time did Dexter Bell spend with Liza when we thought Pete was dead?"
"Good God, John, I don't know. Those first days and weeks were just awful. Liza was a wreck. The kids were traumatized. The house was a beehive, as everybody in the county stopped by with a ham or a pork shank and a spare shoulder to crown, along with a dozen questions. Sure, Dexter was there, and I remember his wife, too. They were close to Pete and Liza."
"But nothing unusual."
"Unusual? Are you suggesting something went on between Liza and Dexter Bell? That's outrageous, John."
"Yes, it is. And so is this murder, the defense of which I'm now in charge of, if there is to be a defense. There's a reason Pete killed him. If he won't explain things, then it's up to me to find a motive."
Flory raised her hands and said,
"I'm done. It's been a stressful day, John, and I can't go on. Maybe another time."
She got to her feet and headed for the door, which he quickly opened for her. He held her arm down the stairs. They hugged at the front door and promised to talk soon. His first meal as an inmate was a bowl of soup beans with a wedge of stale cornbread. Both were cold. And as Pete sat on the edge of his cot and held the bowl, he pondered the question of how difficult it might be to keep the beans warm long enough to serve them to the prisoners. Surely that could be done, though he would suggest it to no one. He would not complain, for he had learned the hard way that complaining often made matters worse. Across the dark passageway, another prisoner sat on his cot and dined under the dim glow of a bare bulb at the end of a cord. His name was Leon Colliver, a member of a family known for making good moonshine, a flask of which he had hidden under his cot. Twice throughout the afternoon, Colliver had offered a swig to Pete, who declined. According to Colliver, he would be shipped out to the state penitentiary at Parchman, where he was scheduled to spend a few years. It would be his second visit there, and he was looking forward to it. Any place was better than this dungeon. At Parchman, the inmates spent most of their time outdoors. Colliver wanted to chat and was curious as to why Pete was in jail. As the day wore on, the gossip spread, even to the other four white inmates, and by dusk, everyone knew Pete had killed the Methodist preacher. Colliver had plenty of time to talk and wanted some details. He got nothing. What Colliver didn't know was that Pete Banning had been shot, beaten, starved, tortured, locked in barbed wire, ship hulls, boxcars, and POW camps, and one of many survival lessons he'd picked up during his ordeal was to never say much to a person you don't know. Colliver got nothing. After dinner, Nix Gridley appeared in the cell block and stopped at Pete's cell. Pete stood and took three steps to the bars. In a voice that was almost a whisper, Gridley said, "Look, Pete, we got some nosy reporters pestering us, hanging around the jail, wanting to talk to you, me, anybody who'll engage them. Just want to make sure you have no interest." "I have no interest," Pete said. "They're coming from all over. Tupelo, Jackson, Memphis." "I have no interest. That's what I figured. You doing all right back here?"
"Doing fine. I've seen worse."
"I know. Look, Pete, just so you'll know, I stopped this afternoon and had a word with Jackie Bell at the parsonage. She's holding up okay, I guess. Kids are a mess, though."
Pete glared at him without a trace of sympathy, though he thought about saying something smart like, "Please give her my regards," or, "Aw, shucks, tell her I'm sorry." But he only frowned at the sheriff as if he were an idiot. "Why tell me this?"
When it was obvious Pete would not respond, Gridley backed away and said, "If you need anything, let me know."
"Thanks." Chapter 5. At 4 a.m., Flory finally abandoned all efforts at sleep and went to the kitchen to make coffee. Marietta, who lived in the basement, heard noises and soon appeared in her nightshirt. Flory said she couldn't sleep, didn't need anything, and sent her back to her room. After two cups with sugar and another round of tears, Flory bit her lip and decided the dreadful nightmare might inspire creativity. For an hour, she fiddled with a poem, but tossed it at dawn. She turned to nonfiction and began a diary dedicated to the tragedy in real time. She skipped a bath and breakfast, and by 7 a.m. was in Clanton at the home of Mildred Highlander, a widow who lived alone and was, as far as Flory knew, the only person in town who understood her poetry. Over hot tea and cheese biscuits, they talked of nothing but the nightmare. Mildred took both the Tupelo and the Memphis morning papers, and expecting the worst, they were not disappointed. It was the lead story on the front page of the Tupelo paper with the headline, "War Hero Arrested for Murder." Memphis, with obviously less interest in what happened down in Mississippi, ran the story on the front page metro section under the headline, "Popular Preacher Shot Dead at Church." The facts varied little from one article to the other. Not a word from the suspect's lawyer or any of the authorities. General shock around town. The local paper, the Ford County Times, was a weekly that hit the stands early each Wednesday morning, so it missed the excitement by one day and would have to wait until the following week. Its photographer, though, had nailed Pete Banning as he walked into the jail, and the same photo was used by both the Memphis and the Tupelo papers. Pete, with three good old boy cops in mismatching uniforms and hats, being led into the jail with a look of complete indifference. Since it seemed as though Clanton was suffering from a case of collective lockjaw, the reporters dwelled on Pete's colorful record as a war hero. Relying heavily on their archives, both newspapers detailed his career and his exploits as a legendary soldier in the South Pacific. Both used smaller photos of Pete when he returned to Clanton the year before. Tupelo even used a photo of Pete and Liza during a ceremony on the courthouse lawn. Vic Dixon lived across the street from Mildred and was one of the few people in Clanton who subscribed to the Jackson Morning Paper, the largest in the state, but one with a slim following in the northern counties. After he read it that morning with his coffee, he walked over and offered it to Mildred, who had requested it. While in her den, he spoke to Flory and passed along his condolences or sympathies or whatever the hell one is supposed to offer to the sister of a man who is charged with murder and appears guilty of it. Mildred shooed him away, but only after squeezing a promise that Vic would save his dailies. Flory wanted everything for her file or scrapbook or nonfiction account of the nightmare. She wanted to save, record, and preserve it all. For what purpose? She was not quite certain. But a long, sad, and also truly unique story was unfolding, and she had no intentions of missing any of it. When Joel and Stella finally returned home, she wanted to be able to answer as many questions as possible. She was disappointed, though, when she realized that Jackson, which was farther away from Clanton than Tupelo or Memphis, had even fewer details and fewer photos. It ran the rather lame headline, "Prominent Farmer Arrested in Clanton." Nevertheless, Flory clipped a subscription coupon and planned to mail it with a check. Using Mildred's private line, she called Joel and Stella and tried to assure them that things at home were not as catastrophic as they might seem. She failed miserably. And when she finally rang off, both her niece and her nephew were in tears. Their father was in jail, damn it, and charged with an awful murder, and they wanted to come home. At 9, Flory braced herself and drove to the jail in her 1939 Lincoln. It had less than 20,000 miles on the odometer and rarely left the county, primarily because its owner had no driver's license. She had flunked the test twice, been stopped by the police on several occasions without penalties, and continued to drive because of a handshake agreement with Nick's Gridley that she would drive only to town and back and never at night. She walked into the jail, into the sheriff's office, said hello to Nick's in red, and announced that she was there to see her brother. In a heavy straw bag, she had packed three novels by William Faulkner, 3 pounds of standard coffee, mail-ordered from the distributor in Baltimore, 1 coffee mug, 10 packs of cigarettes, matches, a toothbrush and toothpaste, 2 bars of soap, 2 bottles of aspirin, two bottles of painkillers, and a box of chocolates. Every item had been requested by her brother. After some awkward conversation, Nix finally asked her what was in the bag. Without offering it, she explained there were a few harmless items for her brother, stuff he had requested. Both cops made a mental note to write this down and pass it along to the prosecutor. The prisoner planned his crime so carefully, he made a list of items to be brought to the jail by his sister. Clear evidence of premeditated murder. An honest but potentially damaging mistake by Flory.
"When did he request these items?" Nix asked nonchalantly, as if it meant nothing.
Flory, eager to cooperate, said,
"Oh, he left a note with Nineveh, told her to bring it to me after he was arrested."
"I see," Nix said. "Tell me, Flory, how much did you know about his plans?"
"I knew nothing, I swear, absolutely nothing. I'm as shocked as you, even more so because he's my brother, and I can't imagine him doing anything like this."
Nix glanced at Red with a look that conveyed doubt in something. Doubt that she knew nothing beforehand? Doubt that she knew nothing about motive? Doubt that she was telling everything? The look exchanged between the two cops startled Flory, and she realized she shouldn't be talking.
"Could I please see my brother?" she practically demanded.
"Sure," Nix said.
He looked again at Red and said,
"Go fetch the prisoner."
When Red stepped out, Nix took the bag and examined its contents. This irritated Flory, who said,
"What are you looking for, Nix? Guns and knives?"
"What's he supposed to do with this coffee?" Nix asked.
"Drink it."
"We have our own, Flory."
"I'm sure you do. But Pete is particular about his coffee. Goes back to the war when he couldn't get any. It has to be standard coffee from New Orleans. That's the least you can do."
"If we serve him standard, then we have to serve the same to the rest of the prisoners, at least to the white ones. No preferential treatment here, Flory, you understand? Folks already suspect Pete'll get a special deal."
"I can accept that. I'll haul in all the standard coffee you want."
Nix held up the coffee mug. It was ceramic, off-white in color, with light brown stains, obviously well used. Before he could say anything, Flory added,
"That's his favorite mug. They gave it to him at the military hospital after his surgeries while he was convalescing." "Surely, Nix, you will not deny a war hero the simple favor of drinking coffee from his favorite mug."
"I suppose not," Nix mumbled
as he began placing the items back in the bag.
"He's not your typical prisoner, Nix. Remember that. You've got him locked up back there with God knows who, probably a bunch of thieves and bootleggers. But you must remember that he is Pete Banning."
"He's locked up because he murdered the Methodist preacher, Flory. And as of right now, he's the only murderer back there. He will not be given special treatment."
The door opened and Pete walked in with Red behind him. He looked stone-faced at his sister and stood erect in the middle of the room, looking down at Nix.
"I suppose you want to use my office again," Nix said.
"Thanks, Nix. That's mighty nice of you," Pete said. Nix grudgingly stood, picked up his hat, and left the room with Red. His gun and holster hung from a rack in a corner, in plain sight. Pete moved a chair, took a seat, and looked at his sister, whose first words were,
"You idiot! How could you be so stupid and selfish and short-sighted and absolutely idiotic? How could you do this to your family? Forget me. Forget the farm and the people who depend on you. Forget your friends. How in the world could you do this to your children? They are devastated, Pete. Frightened beyond belief and absolutely distraught. How could you?
I had no choice.
Oh, really? Can't I explain things, Pete?
No, I will not explain. And lower your voice. Don't assume they're not listening.
I don't care if they're listening.
His eyes glazed as he pointed a finger at her and said, "Settle down, Flory. I'm in no mood for your theatrics, and I will not be abused. I did what I did for a reason, and perhaps one day you will understand. For now, though, I have nothing to say about the matter, and since you don't understand, I suggest you watch your words." Her eyes instantly watered, and her lip quivered. She dropped her chin to her chest and mumbled,
"So you can't even talk to me?"
"To no one, not even you."
She stared at the floor for a long time as his words sank in. The day before, they'd had their usual fine Wednesday breakfast with no hint of what was to come. Pete was like that now, aloof, distant, often in another world. Flory looked at him and said,
"I'm going to ask you why."
"And I have nothing to say."
"What did Dexter Bell do to deserve this?"
"I have nothing to say."
"Is Liza involved in this?"
Pete hesitated for a second, and Flory knew she had touched a nerve. He said,
"I have nothing to say,"
and went about the deliberate business of removing a cigarette from a pack, tapping it on his wristwatch for some unfathomable reason, as always, then lighting it with a match.
"Do you feel any remorse or sympathy for his family?"
she asked.
"I try not to think about him. Yes, I'm sorry it had to happen. But this was not something I wanted to do. They, along with the rest of us, will simply learn to live with what has happened."
"Just like that. It's over. He's dead. Too bad. Just deal with it as life goes on. I'd like to see you trot this little theory out in front of his three beautiful children right now."
"Feel free to leave."
She made no movement except for the gentle dabbing of her cheeks with a tissue. Pete blew some smoke that settled into a fog not far above their heads. They could hear voices in the distance, laughter coming from the sheriff and his deputies as they went about their business. Finally, Flory asked,
"What are the conditions like back there?"
"It's a jail. I've seen worse."
"Are they feeding you?"
"The food's okay. I've seen worse."
"Joel and Stella want to come home and see you. They are terrified, Pete, absolutely frightened stiff, and understandably quite confused."
"I've made it very clear. They are not to come home until I say, period. Please remind them of this. I know what's best."
"I doubt that. What's best is for their father to be at home going about his business and trying to keep a fractured family together, not sitting in jail charged with a senseless murder."
Ignoring this, he said, "I worry about them. But they are strong and smart, and they'll survive."
"I'm not so sure about that. It's easy for you to assume they're as strong as you, given what you went through. But that may not be the case, Pete. You can't just assume that your children will survive this unscarred."
"I'll not be lectured. You are welcome to come visit, and I appreciate it. But not if you feel the need to deliver a sermon with each visit. Let's keep things on the light side, Flory, okay? My days are numbered. Don't make them worse."
Chapter 6. The Honorable Rafe Oswalt, had been the circuit court judge for Ford, Tyler, Milburn, Polk, and Van Buren counties for the past 17 years. Because he lived next door in Smithfield, the seat of Polk County, he had never met either the defendant or the deceased. Like everyone else, though, he was intrigued by the facts and eager to assume jurisdiction over the matter. During his unremarkable career on the bench, he had presided over a dozen or so rather routine murders, drunken brawls, knife fights in black honky-tonks, domestic conflicts, all crimes of rage or passion that usually ended in short trials followed by long prison sentences. Not a single murder had involved the death of such a prominent person. Judge Oswalt had read the newspaper reports and heard some of the gossip. He had spoken twice on the phone with John Wilbanks, a lawyer he greatly admired. He had also spoken on the phone with the district attorney, Miles Truitt, a lawyer he admired less. On Friday morning, the bailiff cracked the door to the judge's chambers behind the courtroom and reported that a crowd was waiting. Indeed it was. Friday just happened to be a scheduled docket day for routine appearances for criminal matters and motion hearings in civil suits. No jury trials were planned in Ford County for months, and normally such a dull lineup on a Friday would attract almost no spectators. Suddenly, though, there was curiosity, and admission was free. The curiosity wasn't limited to the few courthouse regulars who whittled carvings and dipped snuff under the old oaks on the lawn while waiting for some action inside. The curiosity consumed Ford County, and by 9 a.m., the courtroom was filled with dozens of people wanting to get a glimpse of Pete Banning. There were reporters from several newspapers, one from as far away as Atlanta. There were a lot of Methodists, now committed anti-Banning folks, who bunched together on one side behind the prosecutor's table. Across the aisle were assorted friends of Pete and Dexter Bell, along with the courthouse regulars, as well as a lot of townsfolk who managed to sneak away from their jobs for the moment. Above them in the balcony sat a few Negroes, isolated by their color. Unlike most buildings in town, the courthouse allowed them to come and go through the front door, but once inside they were banished to the balcony. They, too, wanted a look at the defendant. No members of the Bell or Banning family were present. The Bells were in mourning and preparing for a funeral the following day. The Bannings were staying as far away as possible. Because they were officers of the court, the town's lawyers were allowed to come and go beyond the bar and around the bench. All 12 were present, all wearing their best dark suits and feigning important legal business, while the crowd looked on. The clerks, normally a languid if not lethargic group, were shuffling their useless paperwork with vigor. Nix Gridley had two full-time deputies, Roy Lester and Red Arnett, and three part-timers, along with two volunteers. On this fine day, the entire force of 8 was present, all in proper, well-starched, and almost matching uniforms, and presenting an impressive show of muscle. Nix himself seemed to be everywhere, laughing with the lawyers, flirting with the clerks, chatting with a few of the spectators. He was a year away from re-election and couldn't pass up the opportunity to appear important in front of so many voters. And so the show went on as the crowd grew, and the clock ticked past 9. Judge Oswalt finally emerged from behind the bench in his flowing black robe and assumed his throne. Acting as if he hadn't noticed the spectators, he looked at Nix and said, "Mr. Sheriff, bring in the prisoners." Nix was already at the door by the jury box. He opened it, disappeared for a moment, then reappeared with Pete Banning in handcuffs and wearing bulky gray overalls with the word jail across the front. Behind Pete was Chuck Manley, an alleged car thief with the misfortune of being arrested a few days before Pete shot the preacher. Under normal circumstances, Chuck would have been hauled in from the jail, frog-marched in front of the judge, appointed a lawyer, and sent back to jail with hardly a soul knowing anything about it. Fate intervened, though, and Manley's alleged crime would now be known to many. Pete moved as if on parade, ramrod straight with an air of confidence and a nonchalant look. Nix led him to a chair in front of the empty jury box, and Manley sat beside him. Their handcuffs were not removed. The lawyers found their seats, and for a moment all was quiet, as His Honor studiously reviewed a few sheets of paper. Finally, he said,
"The matter of State versus Chuck Manley."
A lawyer named Nance jumped to his feet and motioned for his client to join him in front of the bench. Manley stepped over and looked up at the judge, who asked,
"You are Chuck Manley?"
"Yes, sir."
"And Mr. Nance here is your lawyer?"
"I guess. My mama hired him."
"Do you want him to be your lawyer?"
"I guess. I'm not guilty, though. This is just a misunderstanding."
Nance grabbed his elbow and told him to shut up.
"You were arrested last Monday and charged with stealing Mr. Earl Caldwell's 1938 Buick out of his driveway over in Caraway. How do you plead?"
Manley said,
"Not guilty, sir. I can explain."
"Not today, son. Maybe later. Your bond is hereby set at $100. Can you pay this?"
"I doubt it."
Nance, eager to say something in front of such a crowd, bellowed,
"Your Honor, I suggest that this young man be released on his own recognizance. He has no criminal record, has a job, and will show up in court whenever he is supposed to." "That true, son? You have a job?"
"Yes, sir. I drive a truck for Mr. J.P. Leatherwood."
"Is he in the courtroom?"
"Oh, I doubt it. He's very busy."
Nance jumped in with,
"Your Honor, I've spoken with Mr. Leatherwood, and he is willing to sign a guarantee that my client will appear in court when directed. If you'd like to talk to Mr. Leatherwood, I can arrange this." "Very well. Take him back to jail, and I'll call his boss this afternoon."
Manley was escorted out of the courtroom less than 5 minutes after entering it. His Honor signed his name a few times and reviewed some papers as everyone waited. Finally, he said,
"In the matter of State versus Pete Banning."
John Wilbanks was on his feet and striding to the bench. Pete stood, grimaced slightly, then walked to a spot next to his lawyer. Judge Oswalt asked,
"You are Pete Banning?"
He nodded. "I am."
"And you are represented by the Honorable John Wilbanks?"
Another nod. "I am."
"And you have been arrested and charged for the first-degree murder of the Reverend Dexter Bell. Do you understand this? And do you understand that first-degree murder is based on premeditation and can possibly carry the death penalty, whereas second-degree murder is punishable by a long prison sentence?"
"I understand this."
"And how do you wish to plead?"
"Not guilty."
"The court will accept your plea and enter it on the docket. Anything else, Mr. Wilbanks?"
The lawyer replied,
"Well, yes, Your Honor. I respectfully request the court to consider setting a reasonable bond for my client. Now, I realize the gravity of this charge and do not take it lightly. But a bond is permissible in this case. A bond is nothing but a guarantee
that the defendant will not flee, but rather will appear in court when he's supposed to. Mr. Banning owns an entire section of land, 640 acres, free and clear, with no debts whatsoever. And he is willing to post the deed to his property as security for his bond. His sister owns the adjacent section and will do the same. I might add, Your Honor, that this land has been in the Banning family for over 100 years, and neither my client nor his sister will do anything to jeopardize it.
Judge Oswalt interrupted with, "This is first-degree murder, Mr. Wilbanks."
"I understand, Your Honor. But my client is innocent until proven guilty. How does it benefit the state or anyone else to keep him in jail when he can post a secure bond and remain free until trial? He's not going anywhere."
"I've never heard of a bond for a charge this serious."
"Nor have I. But the Mississippi Code does not prohibit it. If the court would like, I will be happy to submit a brief on this point."
During the back and forth, Pete stood at attention, stiff and unmoving as a sentry. He stared straight ahead, as if hearing nothing, but absorbing it all. Judge Oswalt thought for a moment and said,
"Very well. I'll read your brief, but it will have to be quite persuasive to change my mind. Meanwhile, the prisoner will remain in the custody of the sheriff's office."
Nix gently took Pete by the elbow and led him from the courtroom, with John Wilbanks in pursuit. Waiting outside next to the sheriff's car were two photographers, and they quickly snapped the same shots they had taken when the defendant was entering the courthouse. A reporter yelled a question in Pete's direction. He ignored it as he ducked into the rear seat. Within minutes, he was back in his cell, handcuffs and shoes off, reading "Go Down, Moses," and smoking a cigarette. The burying of Dexter Bell became a glorious affair. It began on Thursday, the day after the killing, when old man McGargle opened the doors of his funeral home at 6 p.m. and the mob descended. Half an hour earlier, Jackie Bell and her three children were allowed to privately view the body. As was the custom, at that time and in that part of the world, the casket was open. Dexter lay still and quiet on a bed of shiny cloth, his black suit visible from the waist up. Jackie fainted as her children screamed and bawled and fell all over themselves. Mr. McGargle and his son were the only others in the room, and they tried to render assistance, which was impossible. There was no good reason for an open casket. No law or verse of sacred scripture commanded such a ritual. It was simply what folks did to create as much drama as possible. More emotion equaled more love for the deceased. Jackie had sat through dozens of funerals conducted by her husband, and the caskets were always open. The McGargles had little experience with gunshot wounds to the face. Most of their clients were old folks whose frail bodies were easy to prepare. But not long into the embalming of Reverend Bell, they realized they needed help and called a more experienced colleague from Memphis. A large chunk of the back of the skull had been blown off during the exit of bullet number 3. But that was not of any significance. No one would ever see that part of the deceased. With the entry, though, right above the nose, there was a sizable divot that required hours of skillful rebuilding and molding with all manner of restructuring putty, glue, and coloring. The end product was okay, but far from great. Dexter continued to frown as though he would forever be staring in horror at the gun. After half an hour of private viewing, a perfectly miserable time in which even the experienced and cold-blooded McGargles were pushed to the brink of tears, Jackie and her children were arranged in seats near the casket, and the doors were opened and the crowd rushed in. What followed were 3 hours of unrestrained agony.